The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to another edition of Salute a Veteran Every Day. And our veteran today is a voice you just may have heard before, Mike Edwards. Mike, good morning.
Well, good morning, Frank.
Mike has been a volunteer here for a long time, so I'm just going to lay down and listen. No, I recently found out that Mike is a veteran, an Army veteran, and so I reeled him in to come be with us on Salute a Veteran Every Day. Mike, how'd you come about coming into the Army and then a great career in broadcasting?
Well, I'll put it in a little bit of a contextual response. When I was in college, Vietnam was, you know, reaching its peak back in the late 60s. And so everybody was trying to figure out how to deal with that. And to kind of preface before that, I come from a family of veterans. My mother was an Army nurse and officer and served under Patton during World War II. Yeah. And my dad was a medic initially and later became an engineer for the Army to help rebuild Manila, but he served under MacArthur.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew a little bit about the Army already, you know, growing up. Neither one of them really wanted me to serve. They're very protective about that. That was not their, they're very patriotic, but they also understood the risk that were involved. Yeah. And back then with Vietnam, there was, I lost two classmates within a year or two of graduation from high school in Vietnam. So I knew about that. And one had actually been in college with me for a couple of years. He became a helicopter pilot and was killed in a mission about a year after that.
Yeah, that was a dangerous job.
It was a very dangerous job. Sam, his name, man, he bought into it wholesale. That was the kind of guy he was. And so, you know, all of us were concerned, and the draft was underway. This was not the professional Army as we know it today, but draft Army.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, I signed up. I turned 18 in college, signed up, and I got waylaid for a couple of years so I could finish my degree. And then next thing I know, well, I'm going to have to do something here. So I decided I wanted to learn about aviation. And, well, naturally think of Air Force. So I go over there and talk to the Air Force recruiter, and he said, well, let's start with pilots. So I sat through this huge exam they gave you. And
AFOQT.
Or whatever that thing was. And all day long. And so I thought I was taking the SAT again.
Yeah.
You know. And so I got through with that, and he called me and said, hey, you made it. There's a bunch of you going over to Seymour Johnson to the flight a physician for your physical, and then we'll go from there. So it was early one morning at 5 o'clock. I drove. I had to be there at 5, so I left Raleigh at 4 to be over in Goldsboro. Got there all day long. There were 50 of us. At the end of the day, all but one was accepted. They found a reason not to take us. Mine was swimmer's ear.
Uh-huh.
Ironically, I had been swimming a couple of days earlier, just gone out to exercise. And don't ask me how they figured that one out. But anyway, that's what happened. I said, well, what? So a few days later, the recruiter calls me back and says, I'm so sorry to hear about that, but hey, you're not washed out. We can put you in navigator school, and you can reapply to pilot school later. He says, a lot of people do. I said, well, that's great. So I had to go take the navigator exam. Here I was all day, did the same thing. And finally, I'm out there on the main quad of the campus at the time, and here comes the recruiter one day, and he says, I need to get some more information about, you graduated, right? And I said, yeah, I graduated. I'm just taking some extra courses. And according to them, you didn't. Well, paperwork was all messed up. And so I had to
go
find my
computers back then.
Oh, yeah. It just started with them.
Yeah.
And so I found my senior advisor who was a professor, and he was gracious. He walked me through the whole, we found where the problem was. It took us all day, but we finally got it.
Mm-hmm.
Air Force was happy with that, and they said, we'll stand by. And well, then the next thing I know, I have an appointment to go over, and the guy says, we can't get you in navigator school. It's backed up. And I said, okay, so what's next? He says, what else are you interested in? I said, I'd like to stick with aviation. What else you got? And he said, how about air traffic control? I had to think about that one.
Yeah.
I said, well, let's give it a shot. Now, he said, you go in as enlisted in this program. I said, that's fine. I said, where do you train? I think it was in Mississippi at an Air Force, but after you had budget.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sounds good. Well, several weeks go by. Nothing. I'm thinking, well, tell me when I'm going in. I got to tell my boss, because I was working full-time then in radio. And
where were you working?
WCHL in Chapel Hill.
Oh, yeah.
I was news director there.
Mm-hmm.
And so next thing I know, he comes over one day and he says, I hate to tell you this, he said, but they're a year out on that school, and there's nothing I can do to stop the draft. And let me interject here. You may or may not recall, many people do, during the draft era, before we moved to all-volunteer professional Army, mm-hmm. they had what they call a lottery. And that
I
night,
remember it well.
I'll never forget, I believe it was in January of that, early that year, and they drew numbers. I had all my buddies from school, all the guys in the station who were eligible for the draft, and we sat there. I had the lowest number that night, which was 95, mm-hmm. which doesn't seem low, but when you, the other guys were getting in the upper 200s or 300s, mm-hmm. that was pretty good, and that's where most of them placed. So I said, well, I think so. And so the recruiter told me, he says, a good chance you might be drafted. And he said, I can't stop that. But you have been so good about doing what we've asked you to do. We're going to give you an honorable discharge, which will delay because you've spent 6 months with us.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, and technically I was enrolled. I had taken sworn in and all that stuff. So they created, I was a reservist under there, the way they, the rules ran with the Air Force, which were much different than the Army, as I later learned.
Found out.
And so, anyhow, so I get this thing that said I was dishonorably, or honorably discharged, and it, for reasons not of my making, and they were overbooked and all that, I couldn't get into the school I wanted. So he calls me back a couple of days later, and I think, well, maybe this is good news. And he says, can you come over to my office? And it was in Durham, and I drove over there, and he says, I want to introduce you to somebody. Next thing I know, I'm talking to this Army recruiter and an officer. They were both together and said, we've been going over your resume and everything. You took languages in school. I said, yeah. Would you be interested in going to language school? And if so, would you be willing to volunteer to learn either Russian or Vietnamese?
Wow.
And Vietnam was going on. I said, if I got to go fight, I better know how to speak it. I'll do Vietnamese, you know. And so he says, okay. And so I had orders and everything. Went to basic later that year in September of 70. And it was down at Fort Jackson. In the middle of basic, this officer comes up to me one day and says, Mike, you need to report to the headquarters office, and there's a major on the telephone. He's in D.C. and needs to talk to you. I thought, what? So I go up there, and next thing I know, I'm talking to this guy I never knew. Still to this day, couldn't tell you his name. I actually met him later, mm-hmm. but I still don't remember his name. I remember what he looked like. And he says, Mr. Evers, he said, we got your resume up here, and this is Major so-and-so. And he says, you've got radio experience. I said, yeah. And he says, you've got a journalism degree and all that. I said, yeah. And he says, we need you somewhere else besides in Vietnam and speaking Vietnamese. So we'd like to cancel your schooling at Presidio, mm-hmm. where you do language studies, and send you to East Africa. I said, excuse me?
Yeah. From the Presidio to East Africa.
He says, now, you're going to be filling out paperwork. There's a sergeant there that's going to help you, and you got to do some vetting today. And if you do all that, the next thing I know, I'm spending 6 hours telling my life story, mm-hmm. meeting with a psychologist, filling out all this paperwork. Well, all that was for security clearance. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know what I was doing and why, but I said, why am I doing this? So the next thing I know, I'm sitting on the last day of basic, you know, when you had graduation, and the commanding officer comes in and says, and we won every award that year. We were a bunch of ex-jocks, most of us, and so we loved the competition and had both a mixed reservist National Guard unit, and I was one of two platoons that were active Army. The rest were reservists. So we were a good bunch of guys, great group, great DIs. And the next thing I know, the CO stands up, the commanding officer stands up in front of everybody and says, and we got so-and-so is going to work for the White House Communications, and he was one of the kids in my unit, and another kid was going to Vietnamese language school. And I said, well, dang, why couldn't I have done that? He got to go. And the next thing he says, and Edward's here, he's going to be in Africa after he leaves. I said, what? He'd already gotten the information before I did. And so he called me in the office. And in fact, all of us, there was one guy going to White House, another guy going to language school, me and two others were some kind of specialties. And so we all got special vouchers. Mine was a bus. I took a bus to D.C., got there at midnight. And that's when my first assignment to Arlington Hall Station, which was the headquarters for the Army Security Agency.
I know right where it is.
And so, beautiful little location, and that's where I stayed for 4 months till my clearance got through. And then in February of 71, they sent me overseas to a place called Kagnu Station in Asmara. Back then it was Ethiopia. Today Asmara is the capital of Eritrea. And it was a non-combat assignment, but there were bombings, shootings, people were killed. You had to be on your guard the whole time. It was a great assignment in terms of location.
Yeah.
It was kind of a resort-like place in comparison to some of the assignments you could get. But
and it wasn't Vietnam.
Yeah, no, it wasn't Vietnam. But, interestingly enough, two things about Vietnam. First thing was, my last days at Arlington Hall, and when you get general assignment as an enlistee, you could get anything. I mean,
sure.
The only thing you didn't have to do was KP. And I never did quite figure out how that happened, but I never had to do that other than basic. And so my assignments were to help the general, and if his wife wanted her flowers watered, that's what I did. So I went around and cleaned up around the general's house. He was right there in the center of the base. Great guy and a wonderful guy. And General Denholm was his name. And all the fellas really liked him and his family, and so we'd do anything for him. They were right there. And there was only like a handful of enlisted guys. Most of the guys were officers, so our arms were sore every day from saluting everywhere we went. But that was fine. They were good to us. And so next thing I know, I get my clearance. And so I'm overseas, and I get there, and I'm seeing all these mud huts as the plane's landing. And I'm thinking, holy cow, what am I into now? Well, it turns out I was seeing the rural area outside, the urban area. It was very cosmopolitan, very Mediterranean stucco, that kind of beige look, you know, you see on the Mediterranean coast. And as I got into it, the base that I was assigned to, Kagnu, I became the last of the Army there. Because 2 years later, the Navy took it over. And I worked for the Navy my last few years, few months in the military, and which was an interesting assignment in itself. And my job, once I got there, they told me, anybody who worked at that base, it was a classified operation for years, had to have a security clearance, whether you used it or not.
Yeah.
And so that was why I had to go through what I went through. And we had ops guys who needed the clearance. It was all very, as the term goes, compartmentalized, need to know and all that mess. But our job was headquarters company. We were support, housing, logistics, all that stuff. And my job was base information. I worked for the Public Information Office. I started out as in programming and news for both TV. We had TV, radio, and stereo, FM. And it served both a diplomatic and military audience. And the local people loved us. Interesting thing about the Ethiopian people, Eritreans, most of them average 3 to 5 different languages.
And
they did not have anything above a sixth grade education, but they were very good on languages. So I didn't have. Next thing I know, while I'm there and working and doing TV, doing radio, I did news primarily, and eventually became program director for the operation and second in command under the first sergeant, and worked directly with the major and the captain. And also got to write as a researcher and assistant editor with another colleague the history of Kagnu before they closed out. So our names are in that book, which was kind of cool to be part of that. Wrote for the base newspaper, a media column, talking about what we're going to do and covering different things. And the editor eventually, who worked for the Baltimore Sun later on after his time in the military, talked me into doing general assignment stuff. He liked the way I wrote, so I got to write some articles and do interviews. And I actually wrote one of the last editorials for the paper before it closed out. And the Army left in the end of 72. Navy took over. Now, the Army guys still there serving out. They kept us. The Navy took us in. Mm-hmm. They weren't altogether happy with us Army guys, but they, we had to learn to say, aye, sir, and stuff like that.
Aye.
But it was fine. And I was also on career duty. And the operations center was two 150-foot parabolic antenna. And an 85-foot parabolic antenna. And that was the main center And then they had a listening station outside of that. And all of this was designed to accomplish two things: monitoring Russian and Chinese missiles, and then to listen to aviation traffic and ground traffic and all that. Mm-hmm. And this was all over the world. It wasn't just unique to, because Radio Marina was originally founded by the Italians prior to World War II when they invaded Ethiopia and took over Ethiopia under Mussolini. British and American paratroop assault teams came in and took it back during World War II, and they found out how good that location was. You're about 8,500 feet above sea level, above the Red Sea, and communications allowed us to connect the Navy from the Atlantic to the Pacific, or to the, excuse me, Indian Ocean, mm-hmm. as well mm-hmm. as the various gulfs in the Mideast. So it became a very critical thing. In fact, there's a book out, I think it's called The Red Setting Sun or something like that, by an admiral named Anderson. And it's kind of hard to find, but I read it while I was there. It was in the base library. And the interesting thing, Massawa, which was a Red Sea port, was where they did a lot of salvage work during the war to get American ships back out to fight when they were damaged. And so, and the British used it too. And so they had Massawa days when I was there every year. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. And Prince's Hand came one year to be down there. And one of my best friends from the, he got to be the official photographer for it. Uh-huh. So he had pictures. So, so that's the kind of stuff that I was able to do. And while I was there, I was recruited to teach at the University of Asmara. My job was a writing instructor. And myself and a fellow from Tennessee, I remember his first name was Rick. I can't remember Rick's last name, but Rick was a Peace Corps guy. There were a lot of Peace Corps people right. there, too. And so he and I taught English composition together. He had about 55. I had 75 students, most of which represented different dialects of various languages. I even had one tribal chief who rode using a flashlight taped to his handlebars on his bike from his outside, somewhere outside the city. Every night he came to my class, and then he drove back and took my notes. I gave him extra so he could teach his students there in his village.
What an experience.
Oh, yeah, it was great. I loved it. And it was run by the Vatican. The university was contracted with the Vatican uh-huh. Education Ministry, and phenomenal. My boss, she was a Ph.D. chemistry major from Penn State. She got her degree. And my immediate supervisors were both nuns from the Camboni, I think, ministry they called it, and Sister Anna and Sister Johnson. And it turns out Sister Johnson was a genealogy freak. Found out she and I were 10th related, you know, because I was some Johnson in my family, so it was exciting. Yeah.
Gosh, Mike, well, here I've known you all this time. I haven't heard all this stuff. How about the food there? Talk about the food.
It was amazing. The Army and the Navy kind of shared duties on the chow hall, mm-hmm. and so you could go anytime, 24/7, always a hot cup of coffee ready. Mm-hmm. And it was the Ethiopian local people who were hired to run it. The Navy had just some supervisory roles there, and the Army, too. Terrific. Mm-hmm. Very good food. The guys liked it. We had three clubs, the Officers Club. We had the Enlisted Men's Club, and then, of course, we had the Sergeant's Club, the
NCO.
NCO. Mm-hmm. And so we were able to use any and all of those if we wanted to. You had to be a guest of an officer to go in there if it was an officer. State Department held some receptions there, and I got to go to some of those, mm-hmm. and which was nice. Because State Department was very involved with that base for obvious reasons.
Sure.
But
sure.
They were interested. They had their own communications facilities, and when I was courier, I would always handle a lot of their stuff. So it was interesting to work in those different branches. One of my most interesting assignments was a guy who came in and very sharply dressed. He looked like James Bond. I mean, you know, the guy always to the tie and everything, and he worked for USIS. And I finally said, Tim, what exactly do you do? He says, I run the library here. Well, I later found out, after I read his obituary just a few years ago, Mr. Tim was more than
the library.
Uh-huh. He was big time. He was major, and uh-huh. had no idea. He was very successful at what he did. Mm-hmm. But he spoke one of the most rarest languages, was a form of Norwegian. Spoken in the northern part of Norway.
And that's a tough language.
And he could speak it fluently. And so apparently whatever he did was something tied to linguistics, but he was very good. He retired in Florida, I read about, and that's where he passed away. But great guy to work for. one night I'm sitting there doing the news and knock on the door, and they were very security conscious. They changed the codes to get into the doors every 24 hours. You had to memorize it before you left. Mm. I mean, that's the way they were. Very picky about everything. It's, there he stands out there, dapper as ever, and I'm thinking, do we have a date? And he starts laughing. No, we don't, but I have. He had two projects for me. One was this 10-inch reel of tape, magnetic tape like you used to record on. And then he had a small reel. And he said, let's work on this one first. He says, I've got this interview. Can you do some editing for me? I said, sure. It was an interview he did with a kid there in the library. He supposedly ran. I helped him edit, fixed it, copied it, and gave it back to him. He says, I want you to listen to this and tell me what language it is and see if you can learn anything from it. Call me tomorrow. Well, there's another guy named Roland. Roland was from Texas, and Roland was a darn good engineer and very good background, similar to mine, but a little more diverse, and he's definitely technically minded, which I was not. We sat and ran that tape two or three times, and he looked at me, and Roland said, hold on a second. So he hits this fast-forward button, reverses the tape, and the thing was back. It was a soccer game somebody came. And the reason this tape came into their possession, it was handed to some guy at the airport in Rome as he was flying to Ethiopia, and they were suspicious what this was all about.
It was just somebody
It had gotten it backwards. It was just a soccer game to give to some local. So that was the only time we got into an ops.
That's good. What was it like off? That were you on a base or a post?
I lived both on base and off base. I lived off base for over a year.
What was that like?
Very nice. The landlord was terrific. My little house was a stucco kind of Mediterranean mud kind of thing. I had, a great room, a small kitchen and dining area, and two bedrooms, one of which I turned into an office. And then you collected your rain in this huge barrel, and they only had two rainy seasons there, what they call the short season and the long season. Those were dwindling when I left. That's when that drought that hit Ethiopia so severely had begun, about that time. So anyway, so to take a shower, I had to make sure my rain barrel had my rain in it, and then I could take a shower. And we had to walk. And they had these neat little heater units right next to the shower thing, and you turn those on to get your hot water. It took a few minutes, and that was it. And very conservative. They were very practical people.
Yeah.
They were pretty, very practical.
They had to be.
Very smart. Tin roof. I'll never forget, Roland, I mentioned earlier, I had a shortwave receiver just so I could listen to BBC and other things to kind of keep up with what other news operations were doing. And we had very sophisticated equipment in our offices, but you had to be there and on duty to use those. You couldn't just walk in there willy-nilly. And so I had a shortwave receiver at my home, and one night I got a call, and we were listening to the Super Bowl game. It was carrying it live. Well, the rule was, if you worked out at the message center, you could watch it or listen to it on satellite. But they could not distribute it through the radio station there. It had to be done via shortwave. I'm not sure what...
May have been the rights of the NFL.
Both the rights and also context. They didn't want to know that we had the ability to do that.
Oh, I see.
That kind of thing. You know, when you're dealing in intelligence work, context is as important as content. You know,
exactly.
That's how you put two and two together, so to speak. So anywho... I get this call from the engineer and says, you have a shortwave receiver. Yeah, I said, Roland helped me put up this little antenna, and it works pretty good. What kind of reception are you getting from so-and-so? So I tuned it up. Good. He says, good. Well, took two alligator clips and clipped in the radio to the telephone, and that's how we listened to the Super Bowl on the radio. And so my job was to make sure we stayed on.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Now, what was it like beyond your area there? Was it dangerous to go to travel out to other cities?
We used to do hikes. Pat and I used to go to the Rift Valley, which is huge. That's their Grand Canyon. Loved it. And you could see some of the old, where the soldiers used to have bunkers and stuff. They were still there. And you could see some remnants of artillery occasionally and stuff. A lot of camel caravans passing through at the lower end of the valley, because the salt plains, which were not too far from us, that was 110 degrees. I mean, that was hot down there. I went through them once, and it was very interesting. But in terms of safety, Just before I got there, there was an MP who was shot on the road between Massawa and Keegan. It was some kind of an attack. They never gave us a lot of details, but they warned us when we got there, be on alert. One night, a group of guys were telling me they were in a bar. These guys came in and shoot them out. They wanted no Americans, and then they shot up the place. It didn't kill anybody or injure anybody, but they destroyed the bar.
They let the Americans out first before they
shot up? Yeah, they were very picky about that. And I'll tell you another story related to that, and don't let me forget, because this is even better, I think. Well, the second time, I'm at the office, and all of a sudden the captain comes in. He says, okay, I've got to take a bunch of guys. Edwards, lock all the doors. I'm taking all your men. You're in charge of this station. And if you get the word, you know where the container is. Blow it up.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I knew what he was talking about. I said, okay, here we go. Well, turns out we were under a missile attack, possibly. They found it. It was in Somalia. Sudan, the lower Sudan, which was right above where we were, maybe 80, 90 kilometers. It wasn't very far away. And I said, holy cow. So, you know, we cleared out everybody, and only essentials were there working, and we made sure and we monitored. And only people who were outside of that had weapons, so we didn't even really have any weapons. We had no choice but to get destroyed if that was the case. Well, it turns out that we got an all clear a few hours after that, because there was a few days later. It's a Sunday afternoon, I forget, and we were all sitting there on base just chatting. Next thing, boom, boom, and they had attacked one of our guard posts, and so we all were called in for that, and turns out the Ethiopian army guys were there. They had some ranger trained people, actually trained by the Israelis. And the Israelis and I got to be very good friends, which brings up another story. And that story is the the colonel for the Israeli thing became friends of ours, and he would drop by once in a while to check on the ball scores and stuff. And so one day I'm looking out my office door, and there's this huge parking lot, and he's got a rope in his hand. And he's pulling it back every few seconds, pulling it back and waving. I had to go out, and I said, Colonel, what are you doing? At the other end of the rope, which was probably maybe 30 yards away, was an Ethiopian soldier beating down. He had bought one of these, you know, things you do to cut paper, and that was their letter bomb tester. And they were testing it. It worked. He had figured out a way to pull that thing and figured he was safely away, and that's what he could do. So, but anyway,
well, Mike,
there were many stories.
Your recall is phenomenal, and the stories as well. The time has gone by so fast. I am going to stand up and salute you.
Thank you.
And thank you for being on Salute a Veteran Every Day. We've run out of time, and gosh, it's been great to have you, Mike. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. See you next time.